Imagine you're standing right in the middle of the Sahara Desert at night.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You are miles and miles away from any civilization, any light pollution at all. The air has cooled down, it's perfectly still, and, well, you just look up.
Right. The sky out there is unbelievable.
It really is. The sky is so clear, so completely untouched by like city glow, that the stars don't just look like those flat little pinpricks of light painted on a ceiling.
Yeah, they have depth.
Exactly. They look three-dimensional. You can see the depth, the dark nebulas, the glowing lanes of dust. I mean, the sky feels vast and heavy and, well, completely alive.
It's a very humbling experience.
It really is. And that exact moment under that exact sky is actually what drove Arnold Benz to decode the math of the universe and become an astrophysicist.
Which is a fascinating pivot.
Right. But the thing is, the deeper he got into the equations, the more he ran into this uniquely human problem.
Yeah, and it's a profound realization to have, really. You start by measuring the mass of stars and the trajectories of galaxies, and eventually you're just forced to ask what all of this staggering scale actually means for, the conscious beings looking back up at it.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because in this deep dive, we're looking at sources today that track the entire life cycle of the cosmos.
The whole thing, from start to finish.
Right. We are starting with freezing molecular clouds, tracing the violent birth of stars, mapping the chaotic near misses of our own solar system, and looking ahead to the eventual death of our sun.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. But we're also looking at how those cold, hard scientific facts collide with our very human concepts of creation and meaning.
Yeah, that intersection is key.
So think of it this way. If you were to hold a modern, geometrically precise star chart in one hand, and like a weathered ancient philosophical text in the other, you'd basically be holding the two different lenses we are using today.
Because understanding the reality of the cosmos actually requires both of them. It really does.
So true.
And to really understand our place in all of this, we do have to start at the absolute beginning.
Right.
But the beginning here isn't the Big Bang itself, nor is it some empty black void waiting for a spark. The environment that actually builds us is this messy, chaotic, freezing soup known as a molecular cloud.
Yeah, and I was reading the section on these molecular clouds, and honestly, it seems entirely counterintuitive to me.
How so?
Well, space is famously empty, right? Like a vacuum.
Right.
So if you just have this sparse cloud of hydrogen and oxygen gas drifting in a deep freeze of around minus 200 degrees Celsius, how do those scattered atoms ever find each other to actually bond and form anything meaningful?
Well, in a pure vacuum, they wouldn't.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the gas is far too diffuse for atoms to just, bump into each other and bond. But within these massive molecular clouds, which can span light years across the galaxy, you have these microscopic specks of interstellar dust.
Right.
And at minus 200 degrees Celsius, gases like oxygen and hydrogen freeze directly onto the surface of these tiny dust grains.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they form these incredibly thin ice mantles.
So the dust basically acts like a cosmic meeting place.
Precisely. It is a catalyst. The surface of the grain gives these wandering atoms a physical foundation to meet, interact, and chemically bond to form H2O.
That makes so much sense.
And over billions of years, these tiny ice-coated grains clump together. They actually survive the turbulent formation of our solar system, getting locked into comets and asteroids.
Which eventually bombarded the early Earth.
Exactly, meaning a significant portion of the water on Earth today, the water you drink, the water currently making up your cells,
Yeah.
it was actually formed billions of years ago as microscopic ice mantles in a freezing interstellar
I
cloud.
mean, that is just staggering. You are quite literally walking around filled with melted interstellar ice.
It's pretty wild to think about.
It really is.
Yeah.
But moving from that freezing cloud to an actual star introduces a massive physics problem,
right? Oh, absolutely.
It's something the famous astronomer Laplace puzzled over centuries ago, the accretion disk problem.
Right, the spin.
Yeah, think of an ice skater. When a skater is spinning on the ice with their arms stretched out, they rotate at a certain speed. But the moment they pull their arms in tight to their chest, they spin wildly fast.
Conservation of angular momentum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the same principle applies to a collapsing cosmic cloud. As gravity pulls all that massive material inward to form a star, the rotation speeds up.
Drastically.
Right. And if it spun unchecked, the centrifugal force would literally tear the newborn star apart before it could even ignite.
What's fascinating here is how the universe naturally solves that problem through magnetic tension.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, as the matter spirals inward, it flattens out into an accretion disk around the core of the forming star. Now, the newly forming star has magnetic fields. And because the inner part of the disk is spinning so incredibly fast, those magnetic fields get wound up tight, almost like rubber bands twisting on a propeller.
Oh, I see. And eventually those rubber bands have to snap.
They do. The magnetic tension reaches a breaking point and violently snaps. And this channels immense amounts of matter and energy outward, shooting straight up and down, perpendicular to the disk.
These are the jets, right?
Yes, we call these jets. And they blast out into deep space at staggering speeds, often exceeding 100 kilometers per second.
Wow.
By violently ejecting all this material, the jets carry away the excess rotational energy. They basically act as a braking system.
So they slow the spin down.
Exactly. Slowing the central mass down just enough so it can safely condense, heat up, and ignite into a star without ripping itself to pieces.
So starbirth is definitely not a peaceful dawn. I mean, it is an incredibly violent, messy
It's
process.
very messy.
And speaking of the extreme forces at play, the sources detail how the very first stars in the universe were completely different from our sun.
Oh, totally different.
Yeah, they were absolute monsters, blazing hot, unimaginably massive, and very short-lived. Why were those first stars so radically different from ones we see today?
It comes down to the lack of heavy elements.
Okay.
In the early universe, there was basically only hydrogen and helium. Heavy elements like carbon and oxygen actually act as coolants in a collapsing cloud.
Oh, they cool it down?
Yeah, they help radiate heat away, which allows the cloud to fragment into smaller, more stable pieces. And that eventually forms smaller, longer-lasting stars like our sun.
But the first clouds didn't have those chemical breaks.
Right, so they just kept collapsing into these singular gargantuan stars that were hundreds of times more massive than our sun.
And because they were so massive, the gravity crushing down on their cores was just intense.
Immense pressure.
Yeah, so they burned through their nuclear fuel in a cosmic blink of an eye. And when they died, they didn't just explode in standard supernovae, they died in hypernovae.
Right. A standard supernova happens when a normal giant star runs out of fuel and its core collapses. But these early stars were so huge that their collapse bypassed the standard physics.
What do you mean?
The implosion was so severe it likely formed immediate black holes, and that caused the outer layers to rebound in an explosion orders of magnitude more energetic than a typical supernova.
Orders of magnitude, wow.
Yeah.
And here is the so what for you listening to this
Yeah.
deep dive.
Yeah.
Those cataclysmic hypernovae were the only forces in the universe powerful enough to act as cosmic forges.
Exactly.
The extreme heat and pressure of those explosions smashed basic hydrogen and helium together to fuse heavier elements.
Creating the periodic table, essentially.
Right. Without the violent death of those monstrous early stars, the universe would still just be a boring sea of hydrogen gas.
We wouldn't be here.
No. The oxygen you're breathing into your lungs right now, the carbon that makes up your DNA, none of it would exist.
We are the direct result of catastrophic stellar death. We are literally built from the shrapnel of those hypernovae.
We are made of the universe's wreckage.
It's beautiful in a dark way.
It is. But while that cosmic forge built the building blocks of life, the same chaotic forces are constantly threatening to wipe us out.
That's the trade-off.
Yeah, there is this idea running through the source material that we only exist because of a ridiculous string of cosmic disasters and near misses.
It's a very precarious existence.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I have to challenge the logic on one of these. The formation of the Earth itself.
Okay, let's hear it.
The text states that roughly 4.5 billion years ago, the early Earth was hit by a Mars-sized object named Theia.
Yes, the Theia impact.
Wait, so if a planet the size of Mars slams into the Earth, wouldn't that just obliterate both planets into dust? I mean, so we only exist because of a cosmic car crash. How does a cataclysm of that magnitude create a livable paradise?
It is a completely fair question because a direct head-on collision absolutely would have vaporized both bodies. It would have just left behind a barren asteroid belt.
Right.
But that isn't what happened. It was a glancing blow.
Like a cosmic sideswipe.
Exactly. Theia struck the Earth at an angle. The sheer force of that glancing blow ejected a massive amount of debris into orbit, which, coalesced over time to create our moon.
Which is crazy on its own.
It is. But the true life-saving mechanism of that impact was what it did to our atmosphere.
Oh.
Early Earth was likely wrapped in a primordial, suffocatingly thick atmosphere of carbon dioxide.
Like Venus.
Precisely. If we had kept that atmosphere, Earth would have suffered a runaway greenhouse effect. We would have ended up as a boiling, toxic, Venus-like hellscape.
Wow.
But the impact of Theia physically stripped away a vast majority of that heavy primordial atmosphere, thinning it out enough to allow the planet to eventually cool down, hold liquid water, and, well, support life.
So our paradise was literally born from a planetary hit and run. We survived by sheer chance.
Pretty much.
And that dynamic interaction with the dangerous deep cosmos, it didn't just stop billions of years ago.
No, it's ongoing.
There is this incredible research out of an observatory in Kazakhstan looking at something so terrestrial, so seemingly ordinary. Thunderstorms.
Oh, yes. This is fascinating.
And it turns out the deep cosmos is actively interfering with our local weather.
This highlights the ongoing physical connection we have with deep space. Researchers studying lightning discovered that strikes are frequently triggered by highly energetic cosmic rays.
Okay, break down how a cosmic ray actually triggers a lightning bolt, because honestly, it sounds like science fiction.
It really does. So a cosmic ray is essentially a single high-speed proton fired out of an ancient supernova.
Okay.
And it's traveling across the galaxy at just a fraction below the speed of light. It travels through the vacuum of space for maybe millions of years, completely undisturbed.
Just flying through the void.
Exactly. But eventually, one of these protons slams into Earth's upper atmosphere.
Right.
When that high-speed proton hits an oxygen or nitrogen molecule, the sheer kinetic impact physically knocks electrons off their atoms.
Like billiard balls.
Yes. And those freed electrons then smash into other atoms below them, knocking off more electrons, creating a literal chain reaction.
Like an avalanche of electrons raining down.
Yes, an avalanche. And if that electron avalanche happens to pass through a storm cloud that already has a built-up electrical charge, it acts exactly like a copper wire.
It connects it.
It creates a temporary, highly conductive channel in the air that allows the storm cloud's energy to discharge instantly to the ground. That is the lightning strike.
So a star exploded millions of years ago in deep space, and the direct physical result is a lightning bolt hitting a tree in your local park today.
It's all deeply connected.
It is, but it's also inherently unstable, which brings up this concept from astrophysics called Lyapunov time.
Right. For a long time, the prevailing human view was that the solar system was a perfect clockwork machine.
Very predictable.
Exactly. If you know the math, like the mass of the planets and the laws of gravity, you should be able to predict exactly where a planet will be a billion years from now.
But it's not actually like that.
No, the solar system is actually a chaotic, non-linear system. Because you don't just have one planet orbiting the sun, you have dozens of major bodies and millions of asteroids constantly tugging on each other.
The famous N-body problem.
Precisely. Every tiny microscopic gravitational nudge, say a comet passing slightly too close to Jupiter, it amplifies over millions of years.
It compounds.
Yes. Lyapunov time refers to the mathematical limit of our ability to predict those chaotic orbits. Eventually, the tiny errors in our calculations compound and the clockwork breaks down entirely.
And a perfect example of this unpredictability is the asteroid Apophis. On Friday, April 13th, 2029, this massive asteroid is going to pass uncomfortably close to Earth.
Very close. It will fly closer to us than some of our highest orbiting weather satellites.
That's terrifying.
Now, the math is solid for 2029. We know it will safely miss us.
Okay.
But because it's passing so incredibly close to Earth's immense gravity, its trajectory will be warped. It will pass through a gravitational keyhole that fundamentally alters its path in ways that are, well, chaotic.
So we won't know where it's going next.
Right. Predicting its exact path on its next pass a few decades later crosses beyond our reliable Lyapunov time. The solar system is just not a safe, static neighborhood.
And even if we miraculously dodge every single asteroid, the math maps out our ultimate destruction anyway.
Yes, it does.
In about 1.2 billion years, as the sun gradually burns hotter, it will boil away Earth's oceans completely.
Not a great picture.
No. And in roughly 7.5 billion years, the sun will exhaust its primary hydrogen fuel, swell into a massive red giant, and physically swallow the Earth. The very rocks, the mountains, the remnants of our cities will literally evaporate and mix into the plasma of a dying star.
It is a stark, inescapable physical reality. which naturally forces a pivot in Benz's analysis. Because if the universe is born in absolute violence, sustained by unpredictable chaos, and mathematically doomed to eventual destruction, how does a human being process that?
It's a heavy thought.
Does knowing the cold, hard mechanics of our demise ruin the magic of existence?
Well, there's a famous poem by Walt Whitman called When I Heard the Learned Astronomer that perfectly captures this tension.
I love that poem.
It's great. The poet is sitting in a lecture hall, listening to an astronomer present all these brilliant charts, diagrams, and equations. But the poet gets tired.
He's overwhelmed.
Right. He feels inexplicably sick of all the math. So he quietly gets up, wanders outside into the mystical damp night air, and just looks up at the stars in perfect silence.
It's a very human reaction.
It is. It's like analyzing the chemical makeup of the paint on the Mona Lisa. You can calculate the exact ratio of oil to pigment.
Sure.
That is an objective measurement. But that chemical breakdown cannot calculate the feeling of profound awe you get when you stand in front of the portrait and feel the emotion it conveys.
This raises an important question, though, regarding the limits of our scientific tools. Astrophysics and quantum mechanics are unparalleled in their predictive power, but they have horizons.
Hard boundaries.
Yes. Hard boundaries where our tools and equations simply cease to function.
Give an example of one of those horizons.
Well, the Big Bang is a horizon in time. We can calculate the state of the universe back to fractions of a microsecond after it began.
But not all the way.
No. At the exact, infinitely dense singularity of the Big Bang, the laws of physics as we understand them break down entirely. We cannot peer mathematically beyond it.
No.
Similarly, a black hole is a horizon in space. An event horizon is essentially the point of no return around a black hole. The gravitational pull is so immense that not even light can escape.
So it's an information void.
Exactly. Once something crosses that threshold, no information can ever be retrieved. Science is strictly bound by what can be objectively measured.
And this is where Benz introduces the concept of two different realities, objective measurement and participatory perception.
Right.
Objective measurement is the math. It's the Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics, a mathematical formula used to calculate the exact probability of where a quantum particle might be.
It's perfect for physics.
Yes, perfect for physics. But the Schrödinger equation does not tell the whole story of reality because it purposefully leaves out the observer's internal experience.
The human element.
Exactly. Participatory perception is the human experience of awe, of art, of assigning meaning to the cosmos.
Objective measurement actively requires you to remove the human element to find a universal mathematical truth.
To be impartial.
Right. But participatory perception requires the human element. You are the instrument. You are the consciousness experiencing the silence of the stars.
Now, it's really important to note here that this isn't an argument of science versus spirituality, nor is it validating any specific dogma.
No, not at all.
It's about recognizing two entirely different tool sets for viewing the world. Science explains the how, the mechanics, the fusion, the gravity.
The machinery of it.
Right. Participatory perception engages with the value, the emotional resonance, the human connection. You genuinely need both lenses to fully experience the reality of the universe.
Which brings us to the ultimate synthesis of this deep dive.
So what does this all mean?
Well, if we fully accept the chaotic astrophysics, but we also accept the human need for meaning, how do we talk about creation in a modern scientific age?
Well, the sources strictly reject the traditional idea of a watchmaker god.
The clockwork universe.
Yeah, the concept of an intelligent designer who built the universe perfectly, wound it up like a clock, and stepped back. Benz argues that if the universe were perfectly planned from the start, why is it so incredibly messy?
It is incredibly chaotic.
Why all the catastrophic stellar explosions, the chaotic asteroid impacts, the billions of dead, toxic planets. Mm-hmm. I mean, a perfect watchmaker wouldn't design a watch that randomly smashes its own gears to pieces.
That is where the philosophical concept of creatio continua comes in.
Ongoing creation.
Yes, ongoing creation. The argument is that creation was not a one-time perfect event locked away in the mythical past. Creation is happening right now, in real time.
Everywhere.
At this very second, 30,000 entirely new stars are firing up their hydrogen engines across the observable universe. The cosmos is still actively making itself.
It's an unfinished project.
Yes. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, seeing the universe as a creation isn't a competing scientific theory designed to replace physics.
It's a perspective.
It's a choice. It is a lens through which we choose to view this chaotic, violent, deeply unstable, yet beautiful cosmos as a gift.
And there's a profound ethical implication to that choice. Benz calls it a reverence for development.
I really like that phrase.
Because the universe is not a static, finished machine, because it is an ongoing, open-ended process full of constant risk and novelty, we have an ethical duty to foster that development here on Earth.
We are participants, not just passive observers.
Exactly. There's an old saying he references. You should plant an apple tree today, even if you know the world is going to end tomorrow.
You choose to participate in the ongoing creation, even in the face of ultimate destruction.
It is a radical shift in perspective. You realize you aren't just a biological accident living in the universe. Your consciousness is an active part of the universe's unfolding story.
We are the universe experiencing itself.
Let's bring this all together for you. You are currently sitting on a planet that is quite literally made out of exploded stardust.
Right.
You are breathing oxygen forged in the crushing hearts of monstrous hypernovae. You are drinking water that formed in the deep freeze of a molecular cloud.
Melted space ice.
Right. You are navigating a chaotic, unpredictable solar system. And yet, against all astronomical odds, you possess the consciousness to look up and participate in a universe that is still actively creating itself.
And there is one final physical reality to consider, building on the concept of quantum entanglement.
Oh, this part blew my mind.
In quantum physics, particles can become inextricably linked, mirroring each other instantly, regardless of the vast distances between them.
Spooky action at a distance.
Exactly. A photon of light generated in the core of a distant star remains quantumly entangled with the exact atom that emitted it millions of years ago.
So the connection isn't just metaphorical.
It is entirely physical. When you walk outside tonight and look up at the sky, the exact moment that ancient starlight travels across the void and physically hits your retina, you are making a direct quantum connection with a star millions of light years away.
That is just incredible to think about.
You aren't just observing the cosmos like a movie on a screen. In that exact microsecond, your biological body and the deep cosmos are physically interacting as one single interconnected system.
So the next time you step out into the dark, whether you're standing in your backyard or miles away from civilization in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and you look up at that immense three-dimensional sky, remember that. The universe isn't just something you are watching. It is something you are intimately physically entangled with.